Hashem's involvement in the world is certainly a fundamental principle of our faith. And what's actually quite interesting is that it's nevertheless fiercely debated. And today specifically, we're going to be working on Shitas HaRambam, which is controversial, as probably some of you know. If someone tells you that all important Jewish thinkers believe that everything is subject to providence, they're wrong. If someone tells you that the Rambam denied Hashgacha Pratis, they're wrong. Probably if someone summarizes Rambam's view on Hashgacha in one sentence, they are overlooking important parts of his position. And so if we're going to discover the Rambam stance on Hashgacha, we're going to have to work hard, and there's a lot to see. I told you, and I don't know if anyone got the message I sent last night, but they're really, you know, the Rambam spends a lot of time on it. The Rambam has a series of chapters in Mor Nevuchim, in Chela Gimel, basically Prakim Ches through Chaf Dalet, that are all about Hashgacha, and then he comes back to it at the end of the book in chapters 51 and 54. The Rambam writes that he experienced Hashgacha when he came up with a tremendous chiddush about Hashgacha. He said it was something similar to a prophetic revelation. That's in the Perkhaf base. So the Rambam, his position is very hard. It can't be simplified. When it's simplified, it's usually skewed. I'm not sure I'm quite confident we're not going to fully understand it, but I do think that it's worth working on. The truth is, even though he wrote so many chapters on the topic, there's significant debate about what he actually held. In fact, in 1199, Shmuel ibn Tibon, who was Rambam's preferred translator, wrote to the Rambam asking if he could clarify certain contradictions that he saw in the Mor Nevuchim about Hashgacha. So even in the Rambam's lifetime, even around, you know, among someone who is as great of a Maimonidean scholar as Shmuel ibn Tibon, there was confusion. He saw stiras. And we'll talk about his particular stira and how we might want to answer that question. But it certainly highlights the difficulty in understanding the Rambam's position. And adding to it is also the Rambam's belief in certain types of philosophical or scientific assumptions that we don't find compelling anymore. But I think it is very important. The Rambam emphasizes that his position on Hashgacha comes from the Torah. He doesn't say it's coming from Greek sources. In fact, he rejects Aristotle's view in favor of the Torah's view of Hashgacha. And therefore, it's particularly important to understand the Rambam's Mahalich. So we're gonna look at a number of things he says, and then we'll try to understand what his position is. We'll start off with a piece not from the Mor Nevuchim, but from Mishneh Torah, Hilchos Taniyos, which discusses that a very important aspect of tshuva is acknowledging that suffering or impending danger is hashgacha. V'davar zeh midarkei hatshuva hu, shebizman shetavo tzar v'yizaku alaha v'yariyu, yedu akol shebiglal aseihem hara'im hore lahen. V'zehu sheyigrom lahem lasir hatzar me'aleihem. So part of the process of tshuva is recognizing that the tragedy or the impending tragedy is a result of their averos, and that the way to solve the problem is through tshuva. Avon lo yizaku v'lo yariyu, el yomru davar zem minega olam yiralanu, v'tzarezu nikra nikres. But if they say, no, this is just geopolitics, this is the way of the world, this is nature, this is global warming, whatever it is, hare zu achzarius. This is achzarius. Achzarius is usually translated as cruelty, though here it means insensitive. The goremes lahem lihidabek b'maseh emarayim. So this will cause them to just continue to cling to their evil ways. They won't be learning the lesson. V'tosef hatzara tzaros aferos, which will cause there to be more tzaros. Hushikas b'torah v'halachtem imi b'keri v'halachti imachem b'chamas keri. Kilomar, k'shavi aleichem tzara k'dei she'tashuvu im tomru shehu keri osif lachem chamas oso keri. So the Rambam here is comparing two ways one might react to some type of impending tragedy. One can acknowledge God's hand and improve, which will result in redemption, or one can deny God's role, attribute the events to carry to happenstance, and that will cause God to increase the pain so as to awaken us and inspire improvement. And that's how he understands these psukim. Now, the Rambam here is talking about communal tragedy, communal suffering. And there are some thinkers who argue that there is a greater degree of hashgacha for the tzibor than the yachid. But the truth is that the Rambam writes a very similar thing regarding a yachid in Hilchos Avel, Perek Yud Gimel, Halacha Yud Beis. As you see over there, the Rambam writes that we have to react in the same way to personal tragedy. And he uses the same words about someone who's not misavel karaoi is achzari, as you see over here. And rather, what should the approach be? Yifashvesh v'yidag v'maisa v'nyasa tshuva. So the same approach is basically called for the individual. And actually, if we look in the next source, which is Rambam's letter to the Jews of Marseille, so he makes this point explicitly over there. He quotes the same psukim in Vayikra Chaf Vav, the idea that if you fail to acknowledge the divine cause for the suffering, that will lead to increased suffering. And he applies that to a personal misfortune as well. Before we get to that letter, it's actually kedai to see, you know, the Rambam applied this in his own life as well. The Rambam over here writes about a fascinating sea voyage that he was on. This is when he was fleeing Spain earlier in his life and going to Eretz Yisrael. On Saturday night, the 4th of Iyar, I set out to sea. On Shabbos, the 10th of Iyar, in the year 4925, a great wave almost drowned us, and the sea was raging. I took a vow that on these two days, I would fast and conduct myself as on a full-fledged communal fast, myself and my family and my entire household. And I will instruct my children to do the same until the end of generations and to give charity in accordance with our ability. My vow included that I would sit in seclusion on the 10th of Iyar. I would not see anybody, but rather I would pray and read all day to myself, just as on that day at sea, I found no one but HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I will not see anyone or sit with them unless I'm compelled to do so. And then he writes how when he arrived in Eretz Yisrael, they were safe, and I vowed that to be a day of gladness and joy, feasting and staka for me and my family till the end of generations. So the Rambam, as we would expect, turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at a time of need and attributes his salvation to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention. Now, so there are many parts to Rambam's perspective on Hashgacha. The first thing that I want to stress is that the Rambam stresses justice, divine justice. And he says this in Mor Nevuchim. We'll start with a different source. Again, this is a letter that I mentioned before to the Jews of Marseille. It's from 1194, which is after he wrote the Mor Nevuchim. The primary focus of this letter is Rambam's rejection of astrology. In this section, he summarizes the different perspectives on Hashkacha. And he quotes again the psukim from Vayikra, which tell us that we have to acknowledge the Hashkacha. And he also quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu to emphasize that. And it's important that when reading this, that we note that he emphasizes that the events of the world are not keri. They're not mikra, there's not happenstance. At the same time, and the reason why is because that would imply a lack of hashkacha. There's a lot to see today, so maybe we'll just read it in English. It's a little quicker. We who follow the authentic teachings of the Torah affirm that events befalling men are the result not of keri, but of God's justice. As we read, the prophet comments, you whose eyes are open over all the ways of son of men, right, to give unto everyone according to his ways and according to the fruits of his deed, prima ala love. The Torah further admonishes and bears witness to the fact when it states, but if you will not listen to me, I will administer punishment unto you. Should one, however, maintain that these punishments are not inflicted on account of sins committed, but are casual events which are keri, we are admonished by Hashem that they will keep on increasing these events, chamas keri. It is a fundamental doctrine of the law of Moshe that all events that happen in the world and suffering that befall the way of mikra, in the way of mikra, a result of justice, of din. Din umishpat haim. Our sages indicated this when they said, there is no death without sin and there's no suffering without iniquity. So we should look at that Gemara. We'll see that in a minute, what he's referring to. But what the Rambam is saying is that there is absolute divine justice. All the suffering that a person experiences is just. This is similar to the Gemara we saw a number of weeks ago from Erchin. The Rambam states this explicitly as well in Mor Nevuchim 3:17. And I guess if you just read this, you might think that the Rambam maintains that all events and certainly all suffering in a person's life are a result of providence. We'll see shortly that that is not a tenable reading. The Rambam does think that there is such a thing as teva, and sometimes suffering is a result of teva. So the question that we need to work on is, how are these two things compatible? The Rambam says again and again that everything is just. Rambam also is going to say that sometimes there's suffering due to teva. Now, at first glance, those two ideas are incompatible. If sometimes suffering is just a result of teva, hashkacha isn't all-encompassing, so doesn't that mean that sometimes a person will suffer unjustly? So how does the Rambam consider these two things? I guess one possibility is to say that God would intervene if the result of teva would be unjust. We'll see, though, even that's probably not what the Rambam means. So that's the first issue that we need to consider. The Rambam, again, clearly says that everything is just, but yet, if that's the case, how can teva play a role at all? Teva seems to be pretty arbitrary and unjust. Before getting there, though, let's look at this Gemara that the Rambam quotes here at the end. So the Rambam quotes the Gemara that says all suffering is the result of sin. Now, what's particularly surprising about the Rambam's citation of this Gemara is it doesn't actually seem to be the maskana of the Gemara. Let's take a quick look. It's a Gemara in Shabbos Nun Hei. Amar Aviyami, Ein Misav Ochet Vein Yisurin B'lo Avon. So Ravami says that yes, all death and all suffering is a result of sin. Ben lo yisa be'avon ha'av, ve'av lo yisa be'avon ha'ben. Sidka sa tzadik alav tiyah verisha sa rasha alav tiyah. Ein yisrael blo avon, derchsev ufakadati bashevet pisham v'negaim avonam. Meis vei amu malach yashar shlomei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ribono shel olam, mepnei ma kanas damisa l'adam harishon, amar lahem, mitzvah kala tzivi siv v'avar alaha. Amar lo, v'alo moshe aron shekiyim u'kol atar kula v'meisu. Amar lahem, mikra echad l'tzadik v'rasha l'tov v'chgomer. So we ask a kashon of Ami from a b'raisa. The b'raisa says that Moshe and Aaron were undeserving of death. They were mekayim kol atar kula, yet they died. Why? Mikra echad l'tzadik v'l'rasha. So you see here that it's not true. Ein misa v'lo chet. So who de Amar? Rav Ami said, ki aitana. In other words, taka tzamachlokas tanoim. Detanya, Rabbi Shimon, Elazar omer, af Moshe v'arum v'cheto mesu, shenemar, ya'an lo hemantem bi, ha hemantem bi, adayim lo igiyaz mancham li patem en olam. No, even Moshe Rabbeinu died because of their chataim. Meis vei, arba mesu b'itav shel nachash, ve'luhain, Binyamin Yaakov, the Amram Avi Moshe, the Yishai, the Avi David, the Kalib Ben David. In other words, there are four people who never sinned at all. Even if you're going to say Moshe Aaron died because of their sins, but what do you say about four people who died not having ever sinned? Mani Ilema, Tamid Malachi Ashar Eitzvaik, Moshe Aaron, El Alav Rabbi Shimon Elazar. He. So this must be going a little bit Rabbi Shimon Elazar. Bishma mina yesh meisa b'lo chet v'yesh yishim b'lo avon v'tiyofta d'Rabbi Ami tiyofta sign Rav Ami is shlugged up. In other words, yesh meisa b'lo chet. So takatz machlokas in the Gemara whether or not meisa b'lo chet, but the opinion that says ein meisa b'lo chet, Rav Ami's opinion, the opinion that we just saw the Rambam quote, is rejected tiyofta. And the Rambam quotes Rav Ami, not just here, in other places the Rambam quotes it. It's not just the Rambam, other Rishonim actually passing like Rav Ami as well, which is very strange, right? In a halachic context, you would think certainly the Rambam would never quote a opinion about which the Gemara says it's a tiyufta. The truth is actually the Kesef Mishnah tries to show that the Rambam in Mishnah Torah doesn't paskin like Rav Ami. So that being the case, what's going on over here? So maybe another time, we could talk about this. If you're interested, there's a whole chapter in my Sefer that just came out this past week on this topic, on how the Rambam deals with agadic topics. But without going into too much details, the Rambam on agadic matters frequently accepts what he sees as the Torah's perspective, more broadly speaking. And even though that appears to maybe be a minority view within a particular text or even a rejected view, if we look at the Torah and even Chazal more broadly, we'll see the Rambam, I think, believes that Rav Ami's view is the majority view. Rav Ami, for example, quotes a number of psukim that support his position, right? The dissenting view does not. And there are other Gemaras, Psachim and Bava Kamma and the like, which seem to accord with Rav Ami's view. And moreover, the Rambam thinks that the second perspective that allows for death without sin is very problematic because, like we said before, it seems to deny divine justice. So the Rambam has many reasons why he accepts Rav Ami's view. As I mentioned before, in Mor Nevuchim 3:17, which you have next, he also paskins like Rav Ami. Maybe psak is the wrong word because it's not there's no nafgamina. But he writes over there explicitly that almost all of our sages clearly say there is no death without sin and no suffering without transgression. Now, there's a Rambam over there acknowledges that it's a machlokas, but what's the majority view? Rav Ami's view. Again, how could he say it's a majority view? It's a tiyufta. No, it's a majority view because we have so many psukim and so many other places where divine justice is presumed that clearly that's the correct view. That's the majority view. Now, here he alludes, as I said, to a dissenting view. And again, over here, if you, we're not going to read it inside because we have to keep moving. But if you look, he brings rayas for Rami's position from logic, from Chazal, from Sukkim. So that's the Mahalach of the Rambam here. Now, there's another place where the Rambam says Chazal do seem to acknowledge the possibility of suffering without sin. And that's what Chazal call Yisurin Shel Ahava. Now, what do Yisurin Shel Ahava mean? So the Rambam assumes, and this might be Rashi's view as well, maybe next week we'll see the Ramban has a different Mahalach, but the Rambam thinks that the concept of Yisurin Shel Ahava is that sometimes a tzaddik might suffer to increase his reward. That's why they're Yisurin of Ahava, to show love. Hashem causes them to suffer or allows them to suffer so they get rewarded. The Rambam deals with this when he talks about the concept of a nisayon, and he denies this notion as well. When discussing nisayon, he writes that there is a debate in Chazal whether there's such a thing as Yisurin Shel Ahava. And there are some in Chazal who believe in it, but he thinks it's absolutely wrong. And he goes ahead in describing Nisayon. He goes to every place in Tanakh where the word Nisayon appears, and he shows that none of them imply that there's Yisurin below Chet. Even though a superficial reading might imply that, that's not correct. Just read over here. The principle of the Torah that runs counter to this opinion is that contained in the verse, Kichod Rachav Mishpat ve Kela Muna ve Ein Avel. In other words, the idea that there would be Yisurin below Chet, or the idea of even Yisurin Shel Ahava, is a contradiction to divine justice. Nor do all of Chazal profess this opinion to the multitude, for they say sometimes there is no death without sin and there is no suffering without transgression. And this is the opinion that ought to be believed by every adherent of the Torah who is endowed with intellect, for he should not ascribe injustice to God. So again, the Rambam here is acknowledging there's somewhat of a machlokas, but he thinks that the idea of divine justice shows us that the correct opinion is that there's no Yisurin without Chet. Now, so if so, so then we have a bikasha, right? How do we explain all of hashgacha? How do we explain the idea of hashgacha, especially if we're going to say that it's not all-encompassing? In other words, there is a role of teva. Now, as a precursor, I'll point out that We're going to try to do something when we try to understand the concept of hashgacha that's impossible. The Rambam himself notes this in Chelek Aleph, chapter 72. He writes, "The governance and the providence of Him may be exalted, accompany the world as a whole in such a way that the manner and true reality of this accompaniment are hidden from us. The faculties of human beings are inadequate to understand this." So we can't really understand hashgacha. Now, obviously the Rambam thinks that we should try our best. That's why he spent so much time, more than a dozen chapters, talking about hashgacha. But it does mean that we have to be aware of our limitations here. And as I said, he talks about when he learned this about extraordinary speculation and divine secrets and ideas that came to him in semi-prophetic revelations. What's actually very interesting here is the Rambam at the end of Mon Vuchim 354 writes that understanding the nature of providence is actually part of the perfection that we should all attempt to achieve. Im kein, ha-kavana sher zachra b'zeh pasuk, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, who be a rosh shlemos ha-adam asher bo yishalal be-emes, who lagi al ha-sagas Hashem kefi ha-yicholos, we have to try to have understand Hashem, the ladas hashkachaso bevuav behamtzi'o osam v'henhigu osam, to understand the nature of hashkacha, Echi elalecha sachareya sagah hi bedrachim shiskavim b'hem tamid lasos chesed u'mishpat u'staka lidamos bepulos Hashem. Why is understanding Hashkacha so important? Among other things, because it allows us to be mizdamet to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we have to be like him, in which case we have to understand how he acts, which includes an understanding of Hashkacha. And the Rambam understands that with this pasuk in Yirmiyahu saying, ki bizos yishalal mishalal skel v'yado, so you have to understand Hashem, ki ani Hashem osa chesed mishpat u'staka ba'aretz, ki va'elo chafatzinu Hashem. I, Hashem, do chesed staka mishpat ba'aretz, so that's referring to Hashkacha, ki va'elo chafatzinu, and that's what I want you to do. So we have to imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we do that by looking at his Hashkacha. So before we try to understand the Rambam's perspective on Hashkacha, the first thing we have to do is highlight the position that he's rejecting more than anything else. And that's the position of Aristotle. And the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim 2:22 that Aristotle rejected the idea of miracles. Miracles were impossible. And the Rambam, on the other hand, writes that miracles demonstrate the truth of creation. He writes that if we were to accept Aristotle's theory on the eternity of matter, so in such relation to the universe that he cannot change anything, if he wished to make the wing of a fly longer, reduce the number of legs of a worm by one, he could not accomplish it. That's the Mahalich of Aristotle, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, and the world exists, the universe exists, and God does not and cannot intervene. And the idea of Nisim, though Nisim might be rare, tell us that the approach to Aristotle is absolutely wrong, that God can and does intervene in the world. And that's what the Rambam writes in 2:25, that there's a religious requirement to believe in Briyas HaOlam, and that a lack of belief in Bria would imply, at least if you take the Aristotelian approach, a denial of miracles. So we say Aristotelian approach because there's two approaches to the possibility of the eternal universe. One is Plato, one is Aristotle. Plato's view is not necessarily preclude the possibility of Nisim, and therefore is less problematic. In the end of the day, the Rambam said three times a day, Al nisecha v'niflosecha shebechol eis, erev avoker tzarayim. Right? So there are nisim b'chol eis, erev avoker tzarayim. The Rambam said those words three times a day, and we have to figure out how those words shtim with the Mahalich, he's going to say, in Hashkacha. So now let's begin. So we're going to begin by considering the rejected opinions. The Rambam in 3:17 notes that there are five perspectives on Hashkacha, and the first four that he presents are all wrong. So what are they? So number one is Epicurus. He basically believed that everything that happens in the world is a result of chance. There is no such thing as Hashkacha. That doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. A person could be a deist that maintained that God created the world and then let it be. But Epicurus felt there was no Hashkacha, and the Rambam rejects this view. It runs against the Torah. It's been philosophically refuted, he writes. Number two is Aristotle. Aristotle maintained that on the earth, there's only general and not individual providence. There's general providence with respect to the species and things like the celestial bodies, but no individual providence, no hashgacha pratis for individuals. So everything that happens to a particular individual is by chance. And therefore, there's no difference between a person or an animal. And the Rambam gives a parable over here. I won't read it inside, but it just says, you know, imagine a bunch of people going onto ships. We'll see almost all the Rambam's mashalim about Hashkacha all relate to ships. We saw the Rambam himself experience Hashkacha on ships. His brother died on a ship. It's interesting that he's always going back to that example. But anyway, he says, imagine that there's a ship, there's a hurricane, And it would blow some leaves off of a tree, right? Last night there was a lot of wind, and cause some dust to go in another leaf, and cause a ship to turn over, and cause tzaddikim on the ship to die. They're all the same. In other words, there's no difference between, if you take Aristotle's approach, between a tzaddik dying and somebody smushing an ant. The idea of tefillah is meaningless for Aristotle because Hashem doesn't get involved in an individual. So the Rambam says this view is clearly contradicted by the Torah, which assumes that there is some type of hashgacha, even on individuals. The Torah presumes the effectiveness of tefillah, and therefore, certainly it upholds the idea of nisim, so Aristotle is against the Torah as well. The next two views are two Muslim sects, and they go to the other extreme. And they have a very all-encompassing hashgacha. So the third view is the Asherites, and they maintain that everything is hashgacha, that even seemingly random events, how a leaf falls, that is a result of hashgacha as well. In other words, there's no such thing as nature. Now, we will see, actually, maybe next week, or we sort of talked about it already. There's some Jewish thinkers who deny the idea of nature. Rav Dessler, for example, thinks that there's no such thing as teva. But their view is nothing like the Asheria, because the Asheria deny even free will, because they believe that free will also limits the sphere of God's influence. Now, we talked about last week that there might be a paradox how there could be free will and at the same time absolute divine control, how free will is compatible with Einod Milvado. But at the end of the day, they're both true on some level. Even if you take the most extreme position, you know, b'makom sheish b'chira leka yedia, like we talked about last week. But at the end of the day, there is free will. So then the Asheria, who, as I said, they deny free will because they say God absolutely controls everything. So then why do people suffer? Being, after all, nobody's free. So they're forced to concede that that God is not moral. He could do evil or good as he pleases, because the people suffering are not suffering because of their own free choice. And the Rambam therefore says this, of course, is ridiculous. It's also against the Torah. Tzur tamim pa'alo ki chod rachav mishpat. There is justice, and therefore they are wrong. The Methuselites are also a Muslim religious sect, and they maintain that God directly controls everything that happens in nature, similar to the third group. But they do accept free will. So now we have a question. Well, why does the Rambam reject this approach? Now, this approach is already similar to, it would seem, to actually the perspective that some Jewish thinkers take, which is that there's absolute hashgacha, and at the same time, there's free will. So why does the Rambam find this objectionable? So this is very interesting. We'll read it. Incongruities and contradictions follow necessarily also from this opinion. As far as incongruities, if some human individual is born with an infirmity without having sinned, they, right? In other words, how do we explain that? Somebody's born with a disability. Somebody's born with a disease. How do they explain that? They say, this is consequent upon his wisdom, and it would be better for the individual to be thus than to be with a sound body. So these Methuselites say, yeah, this is obviously God thought this was better for that person. They have a similar answer with regard to the case in which an excellent man perishes, saying that this happens in order that his reward in the world to come be greater, like Yisur and Shalava. Finally, discussion with the, now he, so obviously he thinks that doesn't make sense either. Finally, a discussion with these reached a point at which they were asked, why is he just toward man and not just to what is other than man? In other words, well, why? What about suffering in animals? Because of what sin has a particular animal been killed, right? A lion kills a gazelle. Did the gazelle do an aveira? Whereupon they assume the burden of the following disgraceful answer: this is better for it. In other words, the gazelle, so that God should compensate it in Olam Haba. In other words, they had a big problem. How do you explain the gazelle dying? Everything is just, and there's hashkach about everything. It must be that the gazelle is also going to go to Olam Haba, and that's why it suffered. In other words, even though the gazelle didn't do any particular aveira. So the Rambam seems to be saying over here that it's unreasonable to assume that everything is intended and that nothing is random. It's irrational to think that a leaf fell in a particular way due to divine wisdom, or that an ant was crushed so it gets more Olam Haba. Rambam seems to be bothered here by the fact that some human suffering does seem inexplicable. And so the Rambam is looking for a more reasonable solution to explain things in the world and things that seem to be random. And he also thinks clearly that the idea that hashgacha should apply to everything is problematic. So what is the approach? We're going to see more in a moment, but the Rambam is going to seek a naturalistic explanation that will allow for some degree of providence, maintain free will, and preserve justice. Those are the three things that the Rambam is trying to figure out. And he also happens to think that some aspects of the Methuselite philosophy are unjust, like making someone suffer to give them more reward. So unlike the first three perspectives we've seen so far, there are some Jewish thinkers whose view resembles the Methuselites. There's a famous mice of the Baal Shem Tov, maybe we'll talk about it next week, that says that actually when a leaf falls, it fell for a particular reason. The Lubavitcher Rebbe actually has a mimer in which he discusses whether the Methuselite philosophy is the same as the Baal Shem Tov. And again, when we get to the Baal Shem Tov, we could expand on this. But one important difference is whether the all-encompassing providence is human-focused or not. In other words, even the Jewish thinkers, for the most part, who believe that everything is hashgacha, but it's still human-focused, it's human-centered, it's for the sake of humans. No Jewish thinker that I'm aware of thinks that an ant is crushed so it gets more Olam Haba. That's why I don't think that there's really any Jewish thinkers either that would adopt this approach. Okay, so having rejected the first four approaches, now we're ready for the Torah's perspective. So the Rambam writes like this. The theory of man's perfectly free will is one of the fundamental principles of Torah's Moshe and those who follow the Torah. According to this principle, man does what is in his power to do by his nature, his choice, and his will, and his action is not due to any faculty created for the purpose. All species of irrational animals likewise move by their own will. But that doesn't mean they're of moral free will, like humans. That is to say, that is the will of God. That is to say, it is due to eternal divine will that all living beings should move freely, and that man should have power to act according to his will and choice within the limits of his capacity. And this is very fundamental. Another fundamental principle in Torah's Moshe is this: wrong cannot be ascribed to God in any way whatever. All evils and afflictions, as well as kinds of happiness of man, whether they concern one individual person or a community, are distributed according to justice. Like we said, there is justice. Fine. So what is the Rambam upheld in these paragraphs? Again, like we said, free will and justice. So whatever mehalich we're going to take in Hashgacha has to keep those free two principles while at the same time allowing for some type of Hashgacha. So then the Rambam talks about what he calls his own belief. In other words, instead of, until now, this view is in the Torah. Now he talks about my own belief. Does that mean that his own belief differs from the Torah's? No, it doesn't. What he calls his own belief is because it's not explicit in Torah sources. But he writes, it doesn't contradict the Torah. And there are Torah sources that might even support this. So he thinks it's true. But again, he doesn't want to, he's very careful not to attribute that to the Torah, because it's not explicit in the Torah. So what does he add? So the Rambam here distinguishes between Hashgacha upon humans, which exists, and upon animals, which he thinks does not. The Rambam basically writes that regarding animals, I accept Aristotle's perspective, that God maintains the laws of nature. There's Hashgacha on the species, but not on the individual. Now, why does the Rambam distinguish between animals and people? Why should we be machalik? So the Rambam writes, and it's important, by the way, to note that all of the preceding four views were not machalik between humans and animals, right? Epicurus denied Hashgacha entirely. Aristotle equated man and animal in terms of denying Hashgacha pratis. And the Muslim thinkers, group 3 and 4, both equated man and animal with respect to Hashgacha. So the Rambam writes like this: I've been induced to accept this theory by the fact that I've not met in any of the prophetical books with a description of God's providence otherwise than in relation to human beings. The prophets express their surprise that God should take notice of man, who is too little and too unimportant to be worthy of attention of the Creator. How then should other living creatures be considered as proper objects for divine providence? Aye, but what about psukim that say he gives the food to animals? There are many similar things in Chazal as well, but that's not a kash on me. All these passages refer to providence in relationship to the species and not providence with respect to individuals. The Rambam actually here adds something interesting, which is that that explains why you're allowed to kill animals. If there was hashgacha with respect to animals, then it would be immoral to kill animals to eat. Now, the Rambam indicates here that he sympathizes in a similar, in a sense, with Aristotle's hesitancy about providence. From a philosophical perspective, the notion of Hashgacha is shocking. And the Rambam writes that even the Nevi'im were surprised that mankind should be subject to providence. So why is there a providence, Taka, for humans? And the Rambam's answer is that it reflects the remarkable potential that human beings have. It stems from their ability to connect in a meaningful way with Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's dafka through that connection, the Rambam explains, that there's Hashgacha. And therefore he writes that human beings, this is in 3:18, that act like animals are treated like animals. If you act like an animal, there's no Hashgacha upon you. And be'etzem, there's nothing wrong with killing such a person. You're not allowed to. But fundamentally, it's nothing wrong with it. It's not immoral because they're like an ant. If you live like an ant, then you could be crushed like an ant. How do you live like an ant? By not being shaykh to Hashgacha. How do you not have shaykhus to Hashgacha? By not connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The more a person elevates himself, rising above his animalistic instincts and expressing his godliness, then the more he will experience Hashgacha. And that is the basis of Hashgacha. So let's try to explain this a little better. The Rambam, we have to explain something, which is If the Rambam tells us that there is hashgacha pratis for humans, so does that mean that the world is full of constant miracles, as God is constantly intervening to punish and reward the people? So the Rambam doesn't accept that either. He thinks it's problematic on philosophical grounds that there would be constant intervention. Why is that? What's wrong with that theory? So one aspect that the Rambam emphasizes is that constant change implies a deficiency in the previous state. Meaning to say the laws of Hashem are perfect. To argue for constant hashgacha means that you always have to be fixing something, tweaking something. Imagine you have a car and you always have to fix this, you have to fix that. You're going to new conditions, you have to change this, right? That wouldn't be a very good car. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. And if he constantly had to be tweaking it, so either it means that there's no such thing as nature at all, which the Rambam rejects, or it means that there is such a thing as nature, but Hashem's always having to be misaking it, which is also implies a deficiency. So the Rambam writes that when Chazal said, Olam k'minhago nohig, and interestingly, they were saying that even about Yemos HaMashiach, they meant to say that deviations from nature are quite rare. And moreover, the Rambam says, you know, look, we observe the righteous suffering. So how is that compatible with Schar V'Onesh? So the Rambam, to explain this, comes up with a theory of limited providence. What does that mean? Generally speaking, the world is governed by the laws of nature, but with certain occasional interventions. And the level of intervention is dependent upon a person's worthiness. Like we saw before, animals enjoy no intervention. Humans are capable of some hashgacha. Tzadikim, more. Rishayim, less. Now, that is what the Rambam says, but he says much more. Because that mahalach has two major problems. Number one is that would mean even with respect to tzadikim, there's constant miracles, which he thinks is wrong, right? He's constantly saving them. And the Rambam thinks that's problematic. And two is that it doesn't explain what we sometimes observe, which is even tzaddikim suffer. So to answer the first question, the Rambam writes that even when Hashem watches over tzaddikim, he does so naturally without deviating from the laws of nature. And that's because the Rambam watches over people by means of the intellect itself. The protection of the tzaddik does not come from a lot of small miracles, but is a natural consequence of the tzaddik's connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's through this connection that he's protected. If we take a look over here, according to me, as I consider the matter, divine providence is consequent upon the divine overflow. And the species with which this intellect overflow is united, so that it can become endowed with intellect, and so that everything is disclosed to a being endowed with the intellect, was disclosed to it, is the one accompanied by divine providence. So let's try to explain. So the Rambam, once again, gives a mashal with a ship. He says, you have a ship, right? So the ship is going to sink due to happenstance, he says, mikra gamor. So God would prevent the righteous person from entering the ship. He's not necessarily going to save the tzaddik by some miracle that even though the ship sinks, somehow or another he lives. He'll prevent him from coming onto the ship in the first place. And even if he did choose this ship, then it must be the case that the tzaddik's decision to board the ship is a type of punishment. In fact, here he implies that only with respect to the tzaddik is it necessarily the case that everything that happens to them that's bad is a punishment. Now, what does he mean when he says this takes place naturalistically? So,
Rambam, can I ask you a question?
Let's wait, because we only have a couple of words left, and the Rambam is going to explain all this a little more. So maybe he'll answer it. But Al-Bali Nader, happy to take your question when we're done. So the Rambam writes that that this takes place through divine influence, the divine flow. In other words, hashgacha is not necessarily that the broken ship is going to fail to sink, but rather, like he said, by calling attention to a flaw in the ship that will prevent the tzaddik from boarding the ship, or for his realizing that it's a bad idea because of the weather, or something like that. And it takes place naturally, because since the tzaddik connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through his seichel, so his seichel perceives certain things. The stronger the connection, the greater the divine influence. And that's what the Rambam writes. Now, what does this mean? It's hard to really understand. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu connect to us? The Rambam writes it's sort of similar to prophecy, but it's possible even for people that have not reached the level of prophecy, right? Hence, it follows in accordance with that which I mentioned in the preceding chapter, that the greater the share in which a person has obtained the divine influence on account of both his physical predisposition and on his training, the greater must also be the effect of hashgacha upon him. For the action of hashgacha is proportional to the endowment of the intellect, as we mentioned. The relation of hashgacha is therefore not the same in all people. And the Rambam quotes many, many psukim now that all highlight this point. Raglav, Tzadikim, Yishmor, and so many psukim that talk about how there's a greater degree of hashgacha on, let's say, Tzadikim than other people. But again, the Rambam says this emerges naturalistically. To put it differently, our greatest gift is our mind. And if we correctly use that gift to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we will be spared random or natural occurrences. On the other hand, if we fail to use the gift, so then we will suffer from the whims of nature. Expanding your knowledge of the truth will protect you. That's what the Rambam seems to be saying over here. And then the Rambam writes, skipping a little bit later in the Maor Nevuchim, he said that he had an extraordinary speculation, an incredible vision, a divine secret. So what is it? You have to see the context over here. The Rambam here is telling a person, so how do you develop this connection with Ribono Shel Olam, right? We said before, the Rambam said, that the basis of your relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam is your connection to him. So how do you connect to him? So the Rambam writes that when you start off, so things are, we don't usually connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we need to observe Torah and mitzvos. When you daven, when you learn, when you do other mitzvos, what are you doing? You're training your mind to think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu rather than the matters of this world. And this is true with respect to physical mitzvot, the Rambam writes, and with respect to things like Torah and Tefillah. So you start off by, the Rambam writes, by focusing on HaKadosh Baruch Hu in small times, like when you say Shema, when you daven Shemona Esrei. Then, you know, when you're learning, when you're doing mitzvos. And the more you do this, the more there is. When you say brachos, so what does that do? That causes you to think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu throughout your day. And if when you're performing these mitzvos, you do so in a thoughtful way, it's not automatic. You could also do mitzvos anashim elumada. But if you do the mitzvos in a thoughtful way, if you're thinking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when you do all these mitzvos occupy so much of our day, then it will turn out that a large part of your day will be spent thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And while you're connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're connected to that hashgacha. Now, But what about the rest of the day? What about when you're going to work? So then your connection has been broken. But then the Rambam says, well, if you get really good at connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu while you're doing mitzvos, while you're davening, while you're learning, you don't space out while you're davening Shemoneh Esrei, you're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu the whole time. So then you'll train yourself to even think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu all the time, even when you're engaged in the mundane. The Rambam writes, that's the Madreg of Nevi'im and great tzaddikim. They're able to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu even while engaged in the mundane. They never allow that connection with Ribono Shalom to be broken. And thus the Rambam says that they'll be naturally spared from any mishap. However, he says, when that contemplation is broken, then they are subject to nature. And then he writes, there are some extraordinary people, people like the Avos, like Moshe, who reached a level where they are never, there's no Hesach Hadas, right? So Memela, they're always protected. I don't know if you remember, but a couple of weeks ago when we learned the Sugya of Hashgach of Bitachon, so we mentioned two Mahalchen, one Mahalich, which we saw primarily in Rev Dessler and the Maharal and the like, assumed that if someone has proper bitachon, then they'll never be harmed. So one kasha on that mahalich was, well, how do you explain the fact that sometimes great tzaddikim are harmed? How could that be? So Yitzchak Velashner writes, actually, he takes that mahalich and he says in a chanami that it's because of their lack of bitachon. And that's what the Rambam writes. The Rambam writes as well that you'll never be harmed by teva if you're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the moment that you have Hesach Hadas, now that's extraordinarily difficult. Like we saw last week, you know, when we talked about Rabbi Chanina believed in Enon Mulvado. He believed in this. He was constantly connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore he didn't have to worry about Mechashven. Everybody else in the Gemara, even other Amoraim, felt that was reckless because they didn't have that constant thought. Obviously, there's a difference between the Rambam's view and the Nefesh Chaim's view on this, but fundamentally, they're really saying the same thing. So the Rambam basically seems to be saying here that when a person is engaged in apprehending HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he experiences total providence. And that was the Madrega of Moshe and the Avos and the like. And different people with different Madregos. So some people it's occasional, and sometimes some people it's more, some people it's less. That seems to be the Rambam's Mahalich. That's one aspect. Then there's a big, there's another mahalich that the Rambam seems to say, which sounds like it contradicts this. And this comes out from the Rambam's mahalich in Sefer Iyov. The Rambam talks a lot about the meaning of Iyov. He actually shows how the different characters in the book of Iyov reflect different perspectives on Hashkacha. This is in 323. He writes about how Iov originally accepted the position of Aristotle and the like. Now, we don't have time. It's really kedai to read the Rambam on the chapter. He goes through the book of Iov, and it's a very fascinating explanation, explaining the psukim and the development of Iov. And he writes basically that the first breakthrough that Iov had. Iov starts off, it says he had Yiras Hashem. He was a tzaddik, but doesn't say he was a chacham. And the Rambam talks about the chisaron of Iov. But at the end of the day, when Iov attained that personal connection to God, then his understanding of providence changed. We have to explain it a little more. The Rambam argues that Eov's initially understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not direct. Yeah, he was God-fearing. He shunned evil. But he didn't have direct knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this suffering led to this transformation. And specifically, when Elihu comes, that was the fourth friend whose view is correct, he helps Eov arrive at this truth. And he tells him about Hashkacha. He writes about several times in a person's life, an angel could rescue him from bad circumstances. And how is this so? He goes back to the ship story. So then the Rambam says that sort of Elihu's solution to Eov's problem. You see, one of the tricky parts about the end of Eov especially is you have the whole speech of Elihu, which seems to be right, and then you have the whole vision in the whirlwind from God. And the question is, you know, what is one adding to the other? So Elihu tells him about how Hashkacha works. Aristotle is wrong. He teaches him the idea of Hashkacha. But then Hashem adds something else, a totally different perspective on suffering. In God's description of nature, Eov sees this whirlwind. And basically what Hashem's telling him is that you can't understand all this. God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. And to imagine that we could be able to understand why all things happen, it just means you're a fool. And there's all those psukim describing the perplexities of nature. And the Rambam writes like this, skip down in your sheets to where it says 223. The purpose of all these things is to show that our intellects do not reach the point of apprehending how these natural things that exist in the world of generation and corruption are produced in time, and conceiving how the existence of natural force within them originated them. So we don't understand. Eov's doubts stemmed from the presumption that he could understand God and understand Hashkacha. Now, this is what happened. He suffered. And he said, look, I'm a tzaddik. I didn't deserve this. So he rants and he raves. He says, there must be no Hashkacha. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to him in a whirlwind. He says, where were you when I created the earth? You think you could understand? You can conclude that this is unjust and therefore there is no Hashkacha? That doesn't make sense. That's the second breakthrough that Eov has at the end of the book. And then there's the third breakthrough, which is most important for us. And we don't have time to read through it. It's really kedai if you have a chance maybe over the week to look at some of these chapters on Hashkacha. But more or less, the conclusion that Eov comes to is that Eov recognizes that the primary cause of pain and suffering is not the cause of the suffering, but how we deal with it. And that while pain and suffering is sometimes inevitable, most distress comes from the manner in which people deal with the pain. The reason why Eov was so troubled by his loss of property and wealth is because he cared so much about wealth and property. The reason why he was troubled by his physical pain and physical debilities was because he was too focused on his physical body. If you have the correct approach to this world, then the suffering, then the hard experiences that you go through will not cause suffering to the same degree. The suffering, the Rambam explains, to some degree is self-imposed. And that's what the Rambam writes. Once a person realizes this, that we can't understand the divine, it's going to be simple for him to bear any and all suffering. His agonies will not generate doubts concerning God, whether he watches or he doesn't watch. They're going to increase his love. So the psukim say at the end of Eov, that's why I revile everything that I valued before. That's what the Rambam writes. The Rambam writes Eov's error was that the things that he originally valued, health, wealth, children, they are not the ultimate goal. And so he originally thought they were the goal. So he's devastated when they were taken away. And what he concludes is that true happiness comes from loving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that happens when you know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is in our control. That's the lesson. The Rambam, the Rav, who echoes the idea of the Rambam here and called Odi Dofek, writes, afflictions come to elevate man, to purify his spirit and sanctify him, to clean his thought and refine it of all dregs of superficiality and crudeness, to ennoble his soul and broaden the horizons of his life. Eov learned the lessons of suffering. The suffering purified him. And that's what, that was the lesson. So we're not going to have answers today, but let's at least present the contradictions, the stiras in the Rambam, and maybe next week we'll talk about some solutions. So are there any stiras in the Rambam? The Rambam says four things, and we have to figure out how they stem. Number one, 317, he absolutely affirms divine justice. No one will ever suffer unjustly. That's statement number one you have over here. Statement number two, 317 and 18, he maintains that providence is naturalistic, comes through the intellect. So one and two, how do they relate? Number three, 351, he writes that providence is guaranteed only when a person is contemplating about the divine. And finally, in 323, he talks about the suffering of Eov and seems to conclude that even the person who's intellectually connected to God will sometimes experience misfortune and affliction, but it won't bother him because he has the right perspective on those sufferings. And that seems to contradict certainly 2 and 3, which says that actually if you connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you won't have, you will have absolute hashkacha. And so one, statement one seems to contradict 2 and 3, and statement four seems to contradict 2 and 3, though in the opposite direction. One implies that there's total hashkacha, 2 and 3 have limited hashkacha, and 4 sounds like there's no hashkacha. So that's the shaila. These are part of the shailas. This is what Ibn Tibbon couldn't understand in the Rambam's Bodhivucha. Now, he had a very revolutionary theory. He thought the Rambam really accepted Aristotle, even though he said he doesn't. We'll talk about that, Be'ezras Hashem, next week. I was hoping to finish the Rambam today, but I think it's kedai to spend a little more time on that. And then maybe next week we'll also continue and talk about the Ramban. So everyone should have a good Shabbos, have a meaningful rest of the fast. I hope you feel well. And Be'ezras Hashem, we will pick up next week. I'm happy now to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Rebbe.
Baruch Tiyah.
So my question is the following, based on an earlier thing in here, is that you kind of seem to imply in a way that divine punishment could be a form of providence as well. And that's a pretty interesting thought that I never thought about before, that providence isn't defined as good things that happen to you, but just anything that God does to you. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody would agree to that. Onesh is just as much of a punishment as protection or schar or the like.
Interesting. Okay. So because I've been in a Revel course on Intro to Medieval Jewish Philosophy, so we've been doing a lot of the Mor Nevuchim this semester. Mm-hmm. So we did some of those prakim earlier, but especially the last four of the Morah, so 354, we definitely did. It seems that Rambam's opinion on hashkacha is that you have to have constant mindfulness of God, and that's how proportional to your mindfulness will be the hashkacha.
That's what he sounds like over there. Right. That's what we asked, that does that, how does that fit with 323? That was Ibn Tibbon's question, which we haven't answered yet.
What was 323?
323 is when he talks about the lesson of Eov, and specifically that Eov's lesson is that, seems to be, that, you know, yeah, bad things will happen to good people, but if they have the right attitude towards this world, they won't experience that pain, which seems to be a very different type of solution.
Right.
So.
Right. It's kind of strange because it seems to be that if we go with the idea that providence includes punishment from God, then one's mindfulness won't protect them necessarily. Because
right. Not only that, but it's only tzaddikim, the Rambam emphasizes, that are zocha to providence being a punishment for them.
But wouldn't Rambam say that one with that level of mindfulness is necessarily a tzaddik? Or what's his definition of tzaddik if not?
Yes, no, I think that is who's he referring to. But he says specifically that when a tzaddik who is connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu suffers, that's going to be a result of a punishment, as opposed to, it sounds like, a regular person who suffers, that might be a result of nature.
Mm. Yeah, I can definitely see there are a lot of contradictions here. It's interesting.
Okay.
Things that seem to not like flow one to another.
All right. So make sure to come back next week.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rudy. Like, much appreciated.
My pleasure. Have a good Shabbos.
You too. Take care.